If you have your Bibles, open up to Mark chapter 9, and we're going to spend most of our time in Mark this morning, in 9 and 10, and you'll see it on the screen behind me. We're going to start in verse 31. Jesus said to the disciples, "The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after 3 days he will rise." But they, the disciples, did not understand what he meant, and they were afraid to ask about it. It was several years ago now when I first read about a popular tourist attraction in Austria. Came out maybe 8 years ago or so, 9 years ago. And as you can see from the photos behind me, it is this upside down house that you can go and visit. And not just walk around on the outside, but let's keep going with the pictures. You can see on the inside, it's amazing design on the outside, but you can see on the inside that every room is also built in this upside down, topsy-turvy kind of way. Even down to, let's show the last picture, the garage, where you've got the car on the ceiling. And I imagine if you visit a place like that, it is a little bit disorienting. It's fun, it's exciting, but it's also odd when everything you think should be down is up and everything that should be up is down. And I've seen from time to time images online where roommates will pull a prank like this in one room, right? Someone leaves for the weekend, and I've seen pictures where it is an elaborate prank because they will attach everything to the ceiling. But I have never seen a house like this where outside and in, everything is turned on its head. Now, I want you to imagine for a moment, if you grew up in a house like that, and you had kind of a Rapunzel existence, sort of locked away in this house, so this is all you have ever known. Everything you've ever known is that beds go on the ceiling and tables go on the ceiling and the cabinets that should be up here or down here. That's all you've ever known. And then someone shows up to your house someday and they say, "This is interesting. You know, there's a whole other world out there. And this is actually opposite of the way things should be. Usually, beds go on the ground so you can lie on them. And chairs are on the ground so you can sit in them. And cabinets are where you can keep your things. And cars go on the ground so you can ride in them." And this stranger says, "Now I realize this seems normal to you because this is all you've ever known. But this is the opposite of the way it's supposed to be." That's the message of the gospel. The kingdom of God is near. The kingdom of God is among you. Christ has come, and that changes everything because Jesus turns the world upside down, which is really right side up. It seems odd, it seems off, but Jesus is revealing the way God always designed it to be, the way it's supposed to be. Think back through all the things that Jesus says, which seem upside down, but are really right side up. If you want to save your life, what do? You've got to lose it. If you want to be first, who do you need to be? You've really got to be the last. If you humble yourself, that's when you're exalted. But when you exalt yourself, when you're just about building yourself up, guess what? That's when you're humbled. The blessed people are those that mourn. They're the ones that will be comforted. The blessed people are those who are meek, who seem weak, who don't have much, because they're the ones who will inherit the earth. Now, you've heard that it was said, but I say to you. You've heard that it was said, but I say to you. Now, you've heard that it was said, but I say to you. And nowhere is this more evident than in Jesus' approach and teaching about authority and leadership. Because the model of Roman leadership, which was well known, was everywhere at the time. And it was one that was all about power and prestige. Rome ruled through conquering and then controlling and then lording over others through dominance and might and intimidation. And then they might come around on the backside also and wield control and power through money and wealth and buying influence. And there's a similar mindset that's infiltrated the religious leaders of Jesus' day, where far too many, Jesus says, are concerned about appearance and accolades more than authentic, godly leadership. And so too often, what do we see in the gospel? They rule through religious threat, by intimidating with God at your back and bullying people into doing what they think is right. And then you listen to the disciples, and you can tell that sadly and ironically, they think and hope, along with many other people in their time, that the Messiah is going to combine both of those into one thing: power of the state and power of religion, and bring them all together in one big, powerful conglomerate. You bring all those together, and that's an unstoppable force. And not only did they expect and anticipate that that's what the Messiah would be, but as they started thinking, you know, maybe this is the one, then they also started to hope and expect that their role within the new kingdom would fall in that line. Surely being a part of his inner circle means a plumb position of power. I want to be in your royal messianic cabinet. So I started in Mark 9 this morning. And you may have noticed this in several of the Gospels, and Mark is one where on multiple occasions, Jesus pulls the disciples aside and he gives what's often described as a passion prediction. And usually it comes down to this: hey, just letting you know, I'm on my way to Jerusalem, but it's not going to be what you think it's going to be. I'm on my way to suffer. I'm on my way to be handed over to the hands of those who are in authority. I am on my way to die. And sometimes he'll throw in, and eventually I'm going to rise again. So that section that I started with in Mark 9, immediately after Jesus gives his passion prediction, the disciples start to argue about, can you guess? Do you remember? Who's the greatest? Well, now that's awkward timing, isn't it? Jesus gives a passion prediction about suffering and dying, and they start arguing about who's the greatest. It's awkward timing. It's like all of those times, and many of us, if not most of us, have been there, when 2 minutes after driving away from church, you start to get in an argument about what you're going to eat for lunch. Like, well, that was awkward timing. 1 minute you're like, boy, I really felt the Spirit of God today. Boy, the angels were all around as we sang, which makes me hungry. Where do you want to eat today? And they're like, I don't know. No, you choose. You choose. Okay. How about Mexican? Yeah, I don't want Mexican. We had that Friday night. Okay. Well, how about Italian? Yeah, I'm not really in the mood for Italian. Well, what about Chinese food? Oh, I don't know. You know I don't like to go. Well, what about burger? Nah, burgers are a little greasy. That's too heavy on me. Well, why don't you just choose him? Well, I don't want to choose. I don't really have an opinion. Well, you obviously have an opinion because you shot down four answers. 5 minutes away from the church. In a few minutes before the clouds were parting. And we had that moment where our finger touched the finger of God, like the famous painting. And then 5 minutes later, we're at each other's throat over something that just doesn't matter. How can the disciples go from Jesus telling them that he's on his way to suffer and die 1 minute, and then start to fight over who is the greatest the next? Are they not aware of the contradiction? Obviously not. So, Jesus does what Jesus does. He uses it as a teachable moment. Look at verse 35. All right, fellas. Anyone who wants to be first must be the very last and the servant of all. So you would think that would be that, right? It's like, oh, that was embarrassing. Sorry, Jesus. But I think we got it now. First, last, servant of all. Got it. Not so much. Turn over to the next chapter in Mark 10. There's another time when Jesus is giving another passion prediction. On my way to Jerusalem, I'm going to suffer, I'm going to die, and in 3 days I'm going to rise again. And what follows immediately after is another one of those awkwardly funny exchanges in the gospel. Brothers James and John try to secretly pull Jesus to the side to position for a place of power in his kingdom. And they also try this wonderfully tricky approach, which does not work. Look at Mark 10:35. Teacher, they said, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. I bet you do. Have you ever tried that tactic with a parent when you were younger? Your kids try that, or you try that with a spouse. Before you get to the question, you say yes. I'm about to ask you something, but before I ask, say yes, okay? Say yes. Like, yeah, I don't think so. You're making me more suspicious than ever before. Verse 36, what do you want me to do for you? Jesus asked. They replied, let us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory. Is that all? You don't know what you're asking, Jesus said. Can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with? We can, they answered. Jesus said to them, you will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with. But to sit at my right and my left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared. When the 10 heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. Now, let me stop there for a moment. Because I have a hard time believing that the reason they are indignant is because of moral outrage. James and John, how could you ask such a thing? Don't you know the kingdom is not all about positions of power and honor? We wish that would be their conclusion, but I don't suspect that's where they're coming from. I suspect what they were thinking is, that's not fair. I called shotgun in the kingdom. You had shotgun last time. You got to go up on the mountain of transfiguration. We didn't go up on the mountain of transfiguration. Jesus, this is not fair. This is not fair. I want to sit on the right. I want to sit on the left. So we get another teachable moment. Verse 42. Jesus called them together and said, you know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Now I want to read this exchange that takes place in the Gospel of Luke. In that description, because interestingly, this similar exchange takes place in Luke's gospel right after Jesus institutes the Lord's Supper. And he's got to have the same kind of conversation, but there's a new little wrinkle, little detail in Luke's gospel. Look at Luke 22, 25. Jesus said to them, "The kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who exercise authority over them call themselves benefactors, but you are not to be like that." Now that's an interesting new discussion that's added there. Benefactors. Because that sounds so good, right? It sounds so nice. Normally, when we think of benefactor, we think something really good, someone who's got a lot, who is sharing what they've got to help others. So why does Jesus include that in the conversation and say, you are not to be like that? Well, Roman benefactors gave a lot of money for the common good, to care for the people and build great projects. But the ancient idea of a benefactor is there are always strings attached. It's another position of power. They expect payback. They expect their way. They expect to be recognized. Money is easily used abusively to wield power and influence all the time. It's not just the bullying. It can also be from the benefactors. We see it in politics today. We see it in nonprofits today. Churches see it all the time. Money is a weapon of influence and intimidation. Oh, I'll give if I get my way. And I will withhold if I do not. And Jesus says, but you are not to be like that. I want you to think back to the image of that upside down house. Jesus is telling them, and he's telling us, that everything that we often think about leadership, as far as God's kingdom is concerned, is upside down. It is common for people to lead by dominating. by manipulating, by intimidating, by bullying, by trying to lord power over people. And it is common to use money in those same manipulative ways to get your way. And Jesus wants to turn the world right side up. In the kingdom, one leads through serving. One leads not from the top down, but the bottom up. Christ-like leaders know that they are doing their job, not if they are built up, but if they are building up and lifting up others around them. Because even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. Even to the point of giving his life. It's the message Jesus didn't just say with his lips, but he lived out every day. We remember it most prominently near the end of his life in John 13. When Jesus knows the time has come, his time is near, so what does he do? He grabs a towel and he starts to wash the feet of those who have been following him. He washes the feet of his disciples who he knows are going to abandon him within a very short time. And he washes the feet of Peter, whom he knows is going to deny him 3 times in a very short time. And he washes the feet of Judas, whom he knows is going to betray him in a very short time. He washes their feet, he says, to show the full extent of his love. And he washes their feet, he says, to set an example that we should do as he's done for us. As I wrap up this morning, I want to encourage 2 things. And one is, as we launch into this time of an elder selection process, a shepherd selection process, I want to encourage you to prayerfully look for these kinds of characteristics in those that you would nominate for leadership in the church. We don't appoint leaders based on their business skills or their money-making skills or their prominence or prestige in the community. All those things can be good. All those things can be wonderful. All those things can be beneficial for the church, but those aren't primary qualities of a shepherd of God's people. And it's not a popularity contest. This isn't someone who might serve the church one day if we would only give them the recognition. These are people who are already serving, who are showing themselves in service. This is not someone who longs for power in the church. This is someone who is already empowering the church. This is not someone who tries to intimidate or dominate. This is someone who humbly lifts up, who humbly listens, who humbly works for the good of others and the good of the kingdom and not just themselves. You're not being asked to nominate perfect people. There's only one of those who's ever lived. But you're looking to nominate those who follow in the footsteps of the one who was perfect and lived out his perfection in a way that never sought to be served, but to always serve. And to lay down his life as a ransom for many. And here's the second challenge, and it is for all of us, because we know that being the kinds of servants that Jesus has just described is not reserved for a select few in the church. Every one of us is called to service. Soon we are going to enter into our inside out season of service, which always happens around Easter as a church. One of our favorite times of year, and there's going to be so many opportunities for you if you're new or if you haven't gotten involved, whether that's doing a Feed the Funnel Pack Shack party where we're preparing meals for people who are hungry, about 10,000 plus meals up in the FLC, and we can do that in a little more than an hour, or whether that's with our Night Owls program or our Ronald McDonald House or our children's ministry is going to have another morning of service that we all get to join with the kids in those times, and you'll start to hear about more of those opportunities. But I hope that we remember that as a church, it's not just about an hour or two during special occasions. The kind of thing that Jesus calls us to is a life of service 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Because His interest is not just what you do, but who you are. It's not just a few acts of service. His concern is, are you a servant? So that is the call for all of us.